The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Unlike the regular program I do that focuses upon health, nutrition, the environment, a lot of questions from people in the audience and a special guest, longer guest segments with remarkable minds, this is strictly looking at the work of individuals who have remarkable minds, but unfortunately, because they are progressive, they are not considered a part of the official group of individuals who are given the respect to have a forum. This is their forum and yours. I have a number of commentaries I'll be doing, including my own, and I'll give you a little of the heads up on these. Then, after each one, please feel free to call in and share your points of view. The Revolt of the Elites and the Moral Deficit, from Robert Marx from Tykon. Professor James Petras, On the Empire or Republic, How the Empire Destroys Its Own People, from Joplin, Missouri, Tikbal, Afghanistan. Are We Giant Suckers? While the U.S. blows money on the military, Europe spends money on social programs. Gone with the Papers, Chris Hedges. U.S. Liberty, Government Betrayal and Cover-Up, Finally Exposed, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. This is a really important one, and I'm saving that for the second half of our program. This has not been discussed anywhere that I can find in the mainstream media. For those of you who are concerned about those people who are taking our land, two commentaries. The first, a short one, by Tina Gerhardt from Alternet, The Same Financial Firms Responsible for Our Economic Crisis Are Driving Us Towards a Global Food Disaster. And then Professor Vandana Shiva, who we recently had on this program, The Great Land Grab, The War Against Farmers, All for Profit. So those are some of the issues. Now, time permitting, I'll also talk about what is a way we could get out of Afghanistan completely, 100%, and yet Afghanistan still be able to function even better than now. It's called the Shanghai Cooperative Organization. Are you familiar with it? You may be. If not, this is really positive news. Let's begin. First up, how can we understand this war against middle and working class Americans? Mere mention of the word class reveals the complexity of the problem. The very language of class, we are told, is archaic and pernicious. And yet, to deny the reality of class differences in America, not to speak of the world as at large, is to put blinders on the dry horse. By acknowledging class as a societal reality, we can become aware of how much we have in common with the restless students in Tunis or the harried shopkeepers in Cairo. Let us be perfectly clear, there is a world of difference between the physical conflicts that roil the Middle East and the physical ones that beset American politics. And yet there are similarities too. They both involve poverty, and they both involve class. In the one area of the world, it is jobs and money that provoke mass resentment against dictatorial regimes. In the other, it is jobs and money that reveal the weaknesses of a system that is becoming increasingly unbalanced. What is happening all over the Middle East today is but the image of what is happening in the United States. A huge blanket shaken in the fresh spring air produces undulating ripples spreading freedom to one half of the world and worrisome economic oppression to the other. In Egypt and Syria and Libya, large masses of people rebel against oppressive elites. An opposite process is occurring in America. The elites are rebelling against the masses. Dedicated to protecting their own power and above all their own wealth, these American elites remain passively indifferent as the gap between the rich and everyone else steadily widens. Hysteria about taxes and paranoia about deficits take the place of a coherent political philosophy. The deficit will be placed on the backs of firefighters, and police and teachers, public sector workers who we are told are overpaid and overpensioned. These workers are for the most part union members, and the assault on unions is clearly part of a well-organized strategy to weaken the organizing power of working people. Not immune to the assault on the poor and the middle class are the millions of working men and women, writers, artists, architects, small business owners, struggling to meet life on their own terms. And most vulnerable of all are those who have no jobs, no prospects, no hope. One by one, the doors of compassion are slammed shut. What is astonishing in this whole process is the number of people who are seduced into participating in their own social destruction. The Tea Party movement, after all, is fated to move towards just a destiny, induced to act in ways contrary not only to their own basic interest, but also to their own noblest instincts. These men and women remain stubbornly oblivious to the fact that many of their Tea Parties are financed by the very powers that ought to be their foe. There was a time when growth and expansion were the twin themes that motivated American thinking. This worldwide view was laced with imperialism, the threat of overreaching. But even the threat had its vision. It was expansionist and domineering, but it had goals in its headlights, dreams of a glorious future. Now the dream has been reduced to a nightmare that is totally fiscal in its dimension. Deficit everywhere. Cry the agents of greed. The real deceit is a moral one, an inability to recognize the potential consequences of their own selfishness. The Middle East has its tyrants. The United States suffers from a less visible but no less pernicious form of tyranny. This is the tyranny of huge international corporations that think little of transporting domestic factories and services to offshore destinations. Joining them is the tyranny of class, yes, a class of wealthy men and women who delude themselves into thinking that demanding increased largesse for themselves will translate into increased blessings for the nation at large. In conclusion, I read these words over once more. They sound ardent and theoretical. What is not theoretical is that there are 18 million homeless children in the United States. They cannot read because the electricity in their homes has been cut off. They cannot sleep because they wake up in pain. They are hungry. In the meantime, millions of dollars are given as bonuses to wealthy bankers and money managers. Celebrities flourish and star athletes build their huge mansions. And all the while, the gap between rich and poor grows wider each day. The future is held hostage to the greed of the present. The stock market flourishes, the poor languish and become restive. And as we sit with inertia as our companion, the weeds created by this greed become ever more intractable. Water gradually becomes undrinkable, the air unbreathable. Who still understands that there are roads to repair, bridges to be built, and dreams too? Your thoughts, please. That's one person's view, but one I'm sure that is shared by many. Rarely do we have open and honest discussions in the media on the subject of class. But let me put it this way. How often have we seen those in power actively solicit the input from those who are not, to bring them in and ask them questions that could be important for all of us? In the United States, through my lifetime and up to this moment, power has always been for those who are capable of resting it away and then codifying it, bringing people around them, rigidifying their positions, and maintaining power at all cost. Today we live in nothing less than a massive conflict between reality and various illusions. How do we know that what we believe in is real? How do we know that it's what we should believe in? Where is our capacity to challenge our own personal beliefs and those that we have supported? One of the good things I see at this station, Progress Radio Network, are over 90 individuals who've come together with the idea of trying to reflect a different image back at us. It's your turn now to give us your point of view. 888-874-4888. Now, we all know that we've been told we can't get out of Afghanistan because if we did, the Taliban and some al-Qaeda would immediately take advantage and the country would be back to being in a state of total control and dominance by the jihadist and the religious fanaticist. What are we to do? Well, the answer from John McCain and Barack Obama and all the other people in power is either keep a large force in over 190 different, in effect, small cities throughout Afghanistan, but draw down some troops and then replace them with private contractors doing the same identical work, but because they're not called troops, then you can better spin the idea that we have less boots on the ground who are armed. Indeed, it'll still be the same. Even after all these drawdowns, there'll still be over 68,000 armed people representing American corporate interest in Afghanistan. This, then, is a way of looking at this from Eric Wahlberg. And I'll share this with you now. As the Western elite gathered in St. Moritz to grapple with pressing world crisis, the outsiders met in the bleak steppes of Central Asia. Last week's Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Kazakh capital, Astana, highlighted how the major rivals to empire, led by Russia and China, themselves rivals, are trying to fashion an alternative to U.S. power. This organization is the only major international organization that is neither the U.S. nor any close U.S. ally among its members, and its influence is growing across Eurasia. Leaders of member states, Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, were joined by leaders of observer states, including Iran, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, Mongolia, Belarus, and Sri Lanka. They are all dialogue partners. And prior to the arrival in Estonia to attend the summit, Chinese president visited Ukraine. With the Chinese rhetorical flourish, the Astana Declaration stressed the goal of combating the three forces of terrorism, extremism, and separatism. The summit called for a neutral Afghanistan, meaning no permanent U.S. bases, supported by Afghan President Karzai, even as the U.S. is actively discussing a post-2014 strategic partnership agreement with him. The prospect of permanent U.S. military bases in Afghanistan lies at the core of current U.S.-Pakistan tensions. India has indicated its aversion to a new Cold War, tensions appearing in the region. Russia and China fear that the U.S. plan is to establish permanent bases in Afghanistan and deploy components of its missile defense system. This group meeting there does not want NATO missiles defenses shielding around Europe and their area. The summit also called for Afghanistan's neighbors to play the leading role in improving security and helping to rebuild Afghanistan. Rejecting a purely military solution, quote, "It is possible that our group will assume responsibility for many issues in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of coalition forces in 2014, said the one of the leaders. And, quote, "We are going to be more intensive and deeply cooperative between our group and Afghanistan." Now, what this means in lay language is this. There's a number of countries that intend to work with the Afghanistani people to demilitarize the country, get rid of all of the bases, the security teams, and then bring in members of the Taliban, bring in members of all the different tribes, of which there are many. There's 27 different groups of Taliban alone. It's just not one Taliban. And with Russia and with all their surrounding Eurasian neighbors to work together cooperatively to rebuild the country. China has promised to lend its engineering, and Russia its technicians, and to bring in all that's necessary that everything that has been destroyed would be rebuilt. And then to allow the Afghanistan people to decide what they want to do with their own country. Now, you can ask them, what is the benefit to these Eurasian states? Because then they'll get a gas line that will go from one end of the continent to the other. And transporting gas is very important. It's a major fuel source. But because they're all working cooperatively, and the Taliban are a part of it, you're not going to see the interference that you now have. This is not being discussed anywhere in the American media on any form. And I believe that that's one of the things we should consider for the future. And that's his thoughts. I'm Gary Null, and throughout our program, I'll be giving you comments and thoughts from some remarkable minds. I have at least 6 commentaries. Most are short. One is a little longer, from Chris Hedges. But throughout that, I'll be asking you to call in and share your points of view. For example, on this one, what are your thoughts about all of the media gathering around and supporting us being in Afghanistan, and all the embedded journalists and Fox News and Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and all the rest saying it's important to be there, and the Democrats in Congress not defunding the war? So Democrats and Republicans alike have kept us there. What are your thoughts? I'd like to hear that. Isn't it a radical thought to turn a country back over to its own people? We don't seem capable of wanting to do that. 888-874-4888. Before we go to our next commentary, which will deal with Empire or Republican, how the Empire destroys its own people, from Professor James Petras, a short commentary. Let's say hello to John from New Jersey. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Afternoon, Mr. Gary. I was wondering that, you know, I see so many bad things happening right now. I mean, every time, every corner you look, it's something like ugly, or like you said before, it's a very tumultuous movement. So my comment is, how can you find like the drive to wake up every day and try to be a better person and not to clash with your neighbor or your coworker? How can you do that every day? Sometimes that process wears me out, and I'm like helpless.
All right, it's a fair enough statement. Could you imagine what would have been like to have left St. Louis on your way to California, knowing you had just enough supplies to get you there? Too many supplies and you would have been burdened. Too few supplies and you would have been out of food. As a result, you had to make sure you made it before the winter time, because once the mountain range became covered with snow, there's no way you could get your family and your wagon across there. And then you would have been stuck. You couldn't have survived the bad weather at the Continental Divide, and you didn't have enough supplies to go back to St. Louis. Imagine what it took as far as the strength of character and spiritual perseverance to know that your future and that of your family, and indeed of this nation, all rested upon you having a single-minded concentration each day, that you were capable of doing it. Those who didn't feel confident or capable would not have even tried it. So each day when a farmer wakes up, the farmer does not spend the day thinking, my God, why am I planting these seeds when there could be weevils or slugs or some insect that's going to destroy it? What if I do all this work and I don't get anything at the end? How many farmers do you think have that in their mind when they start their day? So understand that we have two minds each day that every one of us have. No human being on earth is without this. We have the mind that we were born with that is eternal. That is the spiritual mind. When we gain substance and strength through our spiritual awareness, then everything is seen as a positive choice. The choice to know the truth about something, even if in knowing the truth we are exposing ourselves to the contradictions through which we have lived. Oh, gee, I didn't know that liberals could be as corrupt as conservatives. Oh, gee, I didn't know that people on television shouldn't be believed, that maybe they are biased. And one day, we wake up and say, gee whiz, look at the bad choices I've made. I didn't know I didn't need all the things I was buying. I didn't know I couldn't ultimately pay for everything I was buying. I didn't know there was a bubble. So one day we wake up and we get the truth of what we've done. Is that bad to know the truth? It's only bad if we decide not to learn the lesson of our experiences, of our circumstance. But I find every single opportunity to learn from what is going on positive, even if what I'm learning is something bad. When Janine Roberts went to the Congo, it was a very challenging time. Normally, women journalists were not at all welcomed in the Congo because over 1,100 women a day were being raped in the Congo. 4.5 million people had been killed in the Congo. And yet that journey that she took and the story that she brought back allowed us to understand the genocide. Knowing that there was genocide allowed those of us who were concerned about that injustice to address it. Would have been better we not have known? It wouldn't have upset us? I believe that as long as we know the truth, we can deal with it. I don't want to not know something. I don't want to know that cigarettes are bad and people don't want to know the truth. I want to know the truth, even if it makes us change our ways. On the other side, that is the conditioned mind, the mind that tells us that everything that we need to know we have in our tapes, and all we have to do is play a tape. And the tape will tell you whether to commit or not commit to any given thing, in any belief, in any action on any given day. But those tapes are extremely biased, and almost always they're based upon myths. But if we believe in a myth, and enough people believe in a myth, it becomes, for that point in time, a truth. Until we wake up and someone shakes us awake and says, what are you doing? You're eating yourself to death. Well, I didn't know. You shouldn't be eating that food. Well, the FDA didn't tell me not to. The Surgeon General didn't tell me not to. The President didn't tell me to stop eating this food. The people on television who were running the ads for me to buy it, and my kids to eat it. You mean the president of ABC and NBC and CBS and Fox, they don't care about my health or my children's health? Surely they must. No, they don't. They only care about their financial health and then what allows their financial health of the choices they make. But ask them one-on-one. Get the president of Fox by himself and say, do you really care about what advertising does to your listeners and viewers? See if he says yes or no. George Soros made a comment on 60 Minutes once that stuck in my mind. He was talking about how he made his billions. And he said, I really don't ever focus upon the morality of how I make my money. Okay, he at least was honest, most are not. That means that he was willing to trade currencies which caused Russians to go hungry and people in Mexico to go hungry because he was shorting currencies, the peso and the ruble and other currencies. That's how he made his money. But he sprinkled that money around liberal causes and foundations, and suddenly he was a hero because people had the money and they could then live their reality and do what they wanted to do. They didn't look at where that money came from. But if someone asked them, would you take the money from the Koch brothers or the Mellon Chafe, they would say, no, that's conservative money. It's made from, oh, you mean you have a morality about how you get the money if it's from someone in a different political persuasion. These are the conflicts that occur every day in the tapes of the illusion of our lives. So just ask yourself, John, are you willing to wake up each day and make a choice from the spiritual self or the conditioned self? They have dramatically different outcomes of what you will do or not do, become engaged in, or back away from. deny or accept. That's how I would approach it. Does that make any sense to you? John? John's not there? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, makes sense.
Okay.
Makes sense. You just, like you said, like you put the cards on the table and you got to make a decision.
Well, I appreciate your input. Thank you very much, John.
Have a nice afternoon. Bye-bye.
And we have from New Jersey, we have a caller. Let's see who we have up there. Hi, what's your name, please?
Jim,
how are you doing?
Good, Gary. How are you?
Excellent. How can we help you, and what's your thoughts?
Well, a couple of comments. I've heard that there was a report that recently there was a geological survey team, and they came upon a $3 trillion field of lithium over there in Afghanistan, as well as, it seems to me from the history, that ever since the conflict existed between the Russians and the Afghanistans, when the CIA was providing them with training and weaponry and Stinger missiles, they've been wanting to put this pipeline in.
That is correct. But they had a chance to work with the Taliban before all this conflict, before 9/11, and they chose not to. They had an opportunity to pay a fee for the pipelines to be laid, and they decided, after meeting with the Taliban, and they brought Taliban leaders at that point to Texas. They actually met with the oil executives and George Bush, senior and junior. And they decided, why should we give the Taliban any money? Well, because you're taking pipeline across their land, and would be a good idea if they were there to make sure that nothing happened to the pipeline. And they decided that they could make more money by not doing that. It's a matter of historical fact that the Taliban leaders came to the United States and wanted a deal, and we chose not to deal with them. And this is one of the consequences. One of the consequences. Your point is well taken. Thank you very much.
Could I mention a quotation that I came across today that was by Sitting Bull?
Sure.
So let's put our minds together to see what world we can make for our children.
Good. Great comment. I appreciate that. Now, here's something. This is short and to the point. This is from Joshua Holland of Aldernet. Last week, during his final European visit before retiring, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates blasted our NATO allies for spending too little on their militaries. Quote, "The blunt reality is that there is a dwindling appetite to expend increasingly precious funds on behalf of nations that are apparently unwilling to devote the necessary resources to be serious and capable partners in their own defense," unquote. By the way, it's not uncommon for American hawks to whine about those soft Europeans not shelling out enough dough on weapon systems. But take a look at this. In Europe, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development show that they spend 2.5% of their economic output on their militaries. That's a small amount compared to the United States. In the United States this year, we will spend $1.3 trillion on a military-industrial complex that mainly goes to supporting bases around the world that we don't need, massive contractors who are receiving the vast majority of that money, doesn't really trickle down to mean a lot of employees, and creating weapon systems that are then sold to other countries, including for the last 30 years selling our weapon systems and defense systems and intelligence systems to the dictatorships and the oligarchs and the kings of the Middle East, who would then use it against any uprising towards a democratic movement in their own countries. But in Europe, they spend twice as much as we do on social programs, including on healthcare, education, and infrastructure. They have a lot less unemployment, and they also have a whole lot less in the way of infrastructure decline. Europe does almost 80% more work on its infrastructure, bridges, canals, highways, than does the United States. Yet here we are complaining about what they spend. They're not spending enough, and they're saying, for the people of our country, we're spending plenty. And I would ask, when will the people in the media once and for all, if they're capable, stop supporting that we should take away funds for the poor and insurance, health insurance and food supports and all the ways that good money could be used, and instead give it to the voracious appetite of the military-industrial complex. Both the MSNBC and Fox and all the major networks continue to support that we need a strong defense, and how many of those military experts who are paid by the armaments industry appear as talking heads on those stations. So Europe got it right. I believe we got it dead wrong. Now something that, and I'd like your thoughts on that as well, that we will not fund the middle class, the poor, we will not stop the housing mess, and yet we like to believe that we're on the right side of history. Oh, no, we're not. Recently, there was a discussion by a leading expert on our economy, and in a television discussion, I don't think most people heard it in the United States, but it was played in England.
You said last year and again this year and again last month that the U.S. economy was basically sound.
Yes, I did. That is correct. The United States economy is basically sound.
And now you've announced a $1 trillion bailout for the banking and financial sector.
Temporarily.
Oh, you'll be getting it back?
No, they'll be needing more.
Well, in what sense is it temporary?
It's temporarily $1 trillion. We don't know how much it's going to be, really, but temporarily it's $1 trillion that seems to be required.
Well, so how much will it be by the time you're finished?
Well, whatever it takes. We are determined to infuse the U.S. economy with as many dollars, as much liquidity as it takes to ensure the health of the market.
Well, doesn't this mean that the market doesn't work?
No, the market is basically sound. We wouldn't be doing this if the market weren't basically sound.
But President Bush, if the market is sound, why does it need a $1 trillion bailout?
Temporarily.
Well, yeah, maybe $2 trillion.
I might say this bailout is basically sound.
Now, this is taxpayers' money, isn't it? I mean, this is public money we're talking about here.
This is US dollars, young man, being pumped into the US economy in order to ensure that it functions properly.
Isn't this an indication that perhaps the economy isn't working as well as it should?
Well, the economy isn't working as well as it should. It's not perfect. It's got problems. Let's not be in denial about those problems. That's why we're acting decisively, as we are. We're fixing those problems. Those are the very problems we're addressing.
By injecting $1 trillion of public money into it?
Temporarily.
Yes, but how much does it actually need, President Bush?
Well, the market will determine how much money it needs. This is a market economy, and in our economy in the US, the market makes these determinations, so the market will determine how much money it needs.
Oh, yes, so you're now a socialist.
Socialism is basically sound.
Although in a socialist system, of course, you don't just socialise the debt, do you? You socialise the wealth as well.
Well, the mark of an economy and the mark of a society, surely, is how successfully it can help the advantaged in times of uncontrolled avarice.
Well, this is a credit crisis.
Yes, it is. And let's be clear about this. The credit crisis is basically sound.
Is there anyone looking at whether the concept of credit's a good idea or not?
An economy which lends to people who can't possibly pay it back monies which don't exist is basically sound.
President Bush, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Temporarily.
Yes, thanks for that too.
I was just joining you temporarily.
Sure.
I've got other things to do.
Good.
Go and do some of them.
Yeah, like find your brain wherever you lost it when someone dropped him on his head. I think he was probably just used as a softball when he was growing up. His brain, that was. The rest of his body was sitting someplace. And that's who we voted into office. What's amazing is how gullible we are when we allow people like Bill O'Reilly and others who now are the new messiahs, the new voices, the oracles of wisdom in the media to influence us. Unfortunately, we don't see them for who they really are. Patachevsky did. We should pay attention.
Now, Charlie Sheen ranting like a lunatic about the September 11th attacks. Now word comes.
That you know what
I was
doing?
Shut up.
Please, respect.
Why did you have to tell him you were an atheist if you didn't have any trouble reading the oath? Why didn't you just shut up?
What Jimmy Carter should do is privately give Mr. Bush's opinion and shut up publicly. That would be best for the country.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up
once the fighting begins. Once the war against Saddam begins, we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
All he's got in 6.5 years is that I misspoke, that I labeled a Polk Award to Peabody. He writes it in his book. He tries to make me out to be
lying. No, that's
shut
not...
up.
No,
you had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
And starring the mad prophet of the airways, Howard Beale.
Chairman of the board of the Union Broadcasting Systems, and he died at 11 o'clock this morning of a heart condition, and woe is us, we're in a lot of trouble.
So, a rich little man with white hair died. What has that got to do with the price of rice, right? And why is that woe to us? Because you people and 62 million other Americans are listening to me right now, because less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers, because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel, the ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome goddamn force in the whole godless world. And woe is us if it ever falls into the hands of the wrong people. And that's why woe is us that Edward George Ruddy died. Because this company is now in the hands of CCA, the Communication Corporation of America. There's a new chairman of the board, a man called Frank Hackett, sitting in Mr. Ruddy's office on the 20th floor. And when the 12th largest company in the world controls the most awesome goddamn propaganda force in the whole godless world, who knows what will be peddled for truth on this network. So you listen to me. Listen to me. Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We're in the boredom-killing business. So if you want the truth, go to God. Go to your gurus. Go to yourselves. Because that's the only place you're ever going to find any real truth. But man, you're never going to get any truth from us. We'll tell you anything you want to hear. We lie like hell. We'll tell you that Kojak always gets the killer, and that nobody ever gets cancer in Archie Bunker's house. And no matter how much trouble the hero is in, don't worry, just look at your watch. At the end of the hour, he's going to win. We'll tell you any you want to hear. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds. We're all you know. You're beginning to believe the illusions we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and that your own lives are unreal. You do whatever the tube tells you. You dress like the tube. You eat like the tube. You raise your children like the tube. You even think like the tube. This is mass madness, you maniacs. In God's name, you people are the real thing. We are the illusion. So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off right now. Turn them off and leave them off. Turn them off right in the middle of the sentence I'm speaking to you now. Turn them off.
Now just position that today with Rupert Murdoch and Fox, where all the other major media outlets are owned by major corporations, and then ask yourself, are they capable of sharing the truth? Well, look at the world we live in today. A commentary that is important from Chris Hedges. I visited the Hartford Courant as a high school student. It was the first time I was in a newsroom. The Connecticut paper's newsroom, the size of a city block, was packed with rows of metal desks, most piled high with newspapers and notebooks. Reporters banged furiously on heavy typewriters set amid tangled phone cords, overflowing ashtrays, dirty coffee mugs, and stacks of paper, many of which were in sloping piles on the floor. The din and clamor, the incessantly ringing phones, the haze of cigarette and cigar smoke that lay over the feverish hive, the hoarse shouts, the bustle and movement of reporters, most in disheveled coats and ties, made it seem even more exotic, living organisms. I was infatuated. I dreamed of entering this fraternity, which I eventually did. For more than 20 years, writing for the Dallas Morning Star, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, and finally, the New York Times, where I spent most of my career as a foreign correspondent. Newsrooms today are anemic and forlorn wastelands. I was recently in the newsroom at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the patches of the floor, almost the size of a city block, were open space or given row after row of empty desks. These institutions are going the way of the masses, rotary presses that lurked inside undersea monsters in the bowels of newspaper buildings, roaring to life at night. The heavily oiled bemonis, the ones that spat out sheets of newsprint at lightning speed, once empowered and enriched newspaper publishers for who they had a lucrative series of decades, held a monopoly on connecting sellers with buyers. Now that monopoly is gone, and now that the sellers no longer need newsprint to reach buyers, the fortunes of newspapers are declining as fast as the page counts of daily news sheets. The great newspapers sustain legendary reporters like I.F. Stone and Murray Kempton and Homer Bigart, who wrote stories that brought down embezzlers, cheats, crooks, and liars, who covered wars and conflicts, who told us about famines in Africa and the peculiarities of the French, or what it was like to be poor and forgotten in our urban slums or Appalachia. These presses churned out raw lists of data, from sports scores to stock prices. Newspapers took us into parts of the city or the world we would never otherwise have seen or visited. Reporters and critics reviewed movies, books, dance, theater, music, and covered sporting events. Newspapers printed the texts of presidential addresses, sent reporters to chronicle the inner workings of City Hall, and followed the courts and the police. We are losing a peculiar culture and an ethic. This loss is impoverishing our civil discourse and leaving us less and less connected to the city, the nation, and the world around us. The death of newsprint represents the end of an era, and news gathering will not be replaced by the Internet. Journalism, at least on the large scale of old newsrooms, is no longer commercially viable. Reporting is time-consuming and labor-intensive. It requires going out and talking to people. It means doing this every day. It means looking constantly for sources, tips, leads, documents, informants, whistleblowers, new facts and information, untold stories and news. Reporters often spend days finding little or nothing of significance. The work can be tedious and is expensive, and as the budgets of large metropolitan dailies shrink, the very trade of reporting declines. Most city papers, at their zenith, employed several hundred reporters and editors and had operating budgets in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The steady decline of the news business means we are plunging larger and larger parts of our society into dark holes and opening up greater opportunities for unchecked corruption, disinformation, and the abuse of power. A democracy survives when its citizens have access to trustworthy and impartial sources of information, when it can discern lies from truth, when civic discourse is grounded in verifiable fact. And with the decimation of reporting, these sources of information are disappearing. The increasing fusion of news and entertainment, the rise of a class of celebrity journalists on television who absolutely define reporting by their access to the famous and powerful, the retreat by many readers into the ideological ghettos of the Internet, and the ruthless drive by corporations to destroy the traditional news business are leaving us deaf, dumb, and blind. The relentless assault on the liberal press by the right-wing propaganda outlets such as Fox News or the Christian right is in fact an assault on a system of information grounded in verifiable fact. And once this bedrock of civil discourse is eradicated, people will be free, as many already are, to believe whatever they want to believe, to pick and choose what facts or opinions suit their world and what to do. In this view, world lies will become true. I, like many who cared more about truth than news, was pushed out of the New York Times, specifically over my vocal and public opposition to the war in Iraq. This is not a new story. Those reporters who persistently challenged the orthodoxy of belief, who questioned and examined the reigning political passions, always tacitly embraced by the commercial media, are often banished. There is a constant battle in newsrooms between the managers, those who serve the interests of the institution and the needs of the advertisers, and the reporters whose loyalty is to the readers. I have a great affection for the reporters, who hide their idealism behind a thin veneer of cynicism and worldliness. I also harbor a deep distrust and even loathing for the careerists who rise up the food chain to become managers and editors. Sidney Schamberg was nearly killed in Cambodia in 1975 after staying there for the New York Times to cover the conquest of Phnom Penh by the Khmer Rouge, reporting for which he won the Pulitzer Prize. Later, he went back to New York and from Cambodia and ran the city desk. He pushed reporters to report about the homeless, the poor, and the victims of developers who were forcing families out of their rent-controlled apartments. But it was not a good time to give a voice to the weak and the poor. The social movements built around the opposition to the Vietnam War had dissolved. Alternative publications, including the magazine Ramparts, which through a series of exposés had embarrassed the establishment media organizations into doing real reporting, had gone out of business. The commercial press had once again become lethargic. It had less and less incentive to challenge the power elite. Many editors viewed Schamberg's concern as relics of a dead era. He was removed as city editor and assigned to write a column about New York. He used the column, however, to again decry the abuse of the powerful, especially developers. The then editor of the paper, Abe Rosenthal, became an acid challenger of Schamberg. He called him the resident commie and addressed him as St. Francis. Rosenthal, who met William F. Buckley almost weekly for lunch, along with the paper's publisher, Arthur Punch Schulzberg, grew increasingly impatient with Schamberg, who had challenged the activities of their powerful friends. Schamberg became a pariah. He was not invited to the paper's table at two consecutive inner circle dinners held for New York reporters. The senior editors and the publisher did not attend the previews of his film, The Killing Fields, based upon Schamberg's experience in Cambodia. His days at the newspaper were numbered. The city Schamberg profiled in his column did not look like the glossy ads in Rosenthal's new lifestyle sections or the New York Sunday Times magazine. Schamberg City was one in which thousands of citizens were sleeping on the streets. It was one where there were lines at soup kitchens. It was a city where the mentally ill were thrown onto heating grates or into jails like human refuge. He wrote of people who were unable to afford housing. He lost his column and left the paper to work for the New York Newsday and later the Village Voice. Schamberg's story was one of many. The best reporters almost always run afoul of the Mandarins above them, a clash that sees them defanged and demoted or driven out. They are banished by a class of careerists whom the war correspondent Homer Bigert dismissed as the pygmies. One evening, Bigert was assigned to write about a riot. Drawing from the information provided by reporters on the scene, as one reporter, John Keifner, called in from a phone booth, writing began to shake it. Keifner relayed the distressing bit of news to Bigert, who, sick of the needling of his editors, reassured Keifner with the words, at least you're dealing with sane people. Those who insist on reporting uncomfortable truths always try the patience of the careerist who manage these institutions. If they are too persistent, as most good reporters are, they become a problem. This battle, which exists in all newsrooms, are summed up for me by the Los Angeles Times reporter Dial Thorgensen, whom I worked with in Central America until he was killed by a landmine on the border between Honduras and Nicaragua. He said, "Always remember, they are the enemy." When I met with Schamburg in his apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side, he told me, I heard all kinds of reports over the years that the wealthy patrons of the Metropolitan Museum of Art would often get to use the customs clearance provided to the museum to import personal items, including jewelry, which was not going to the museum. I can't prove this, but I believe it's true. Would the Times investigate this? Not in a million years. The publisher at the time was the chairman of the board of the museum. These were his friends. But Schamburg also argues, as do I, that the newspapers prove a vital bulwark for a democratic state. It is possible to decry their numerous failings and compromises with the power elite, and yet finally honor them as important to the maintenance of democracy. Traditionally, if a reporter goes out and reports on an event, the information is usually trustworthy and accurate. The report can be slanted or biased. It can leave out vital facts. But it is not fiction. The day the New York Times and other great city newspapers die, if such a day comes, will be a black day for the nation. Newspapers do more than anyone else, although they left out a lot of things, Schamburg said. There are stories on their blackout list, but it's important the paper is there because they spend money on what they choose to cover. Most of the problem of mainstream journalism is what they leave out. But what they do, aside from the daily boilerplate, press releases and so forth, is very, very important to the democratic process. Papers function as a guide to newcomers, to immigrants, as to what the ethos is, what the rules are, how we're supposed to behave. That is not always good, obviously, because this is the consensus of the establishment. The papers, probably more in the earlier years than now, print texts of things people will never see elsewhere. It tells them what you have to do to cast a vote. It covers things like the swearing in of immigrants. They are a positive force. I don't think the New York Times was ever fully committed to accountability as a paper. I'm not sure there is one. I don't know who coined the phrase, but it fits the newspaper. Afghanistanism means you can cover all the corruption you find in Afghanistan, but don't try to do it in your own backyard. Chris Hedges, your thoughts. My thoughts? I was able to do over 78 major stories for magazines, national magazines, 28 cover stories alone for one magazine on corruption within the medical community. It was called Medical Genocide. 60 Minutes picked up a story, 2020 picked up the story, many other people used this. It was only because the publisher, Robert Guccione, had the courage to allow, against even the advice of his editor-in-chief and managing editor and lawyers, to allow these stories to be published. Because of this, today many people know of alternative treatments they would not have otherwise known, and doctors like Stanislaw Brzezinski, who I helped uncover the challenge against him, were given another day to practice. I wish there were magazines like that today, and with the exception of only a handful, like Mother Jones, you do not have that freedom of reporting the truth. The New York Times reports some very important stories, but it will not report much of the truth, as many of us in the alternative field and certainly progressive field know. That's why this network exists. And much of what you see on the internet is very important, but much of it's misleading, and much of it is not based upon the good scholarship that Chris Hedges and other good reporters bring to a story. I wished it were otherwise. And I wish that many people like Chris Hedges would come forward and do more on the internet. And that day hopefully will come. Some final thoughts from you before I go to our final commentary I've saved for last by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Our number is 888-874-4888. June 8, 1967, the fourth day of the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, was a beautiful day in the Mediterranean. The USS Liberty was in international waters off the coast of Egypt. Israel aircraft had flown over the USS Liberty in the morning and had reported that the ship was American. The crew, in close proximity to the war zone, was reassured by the presence of Israeli aircraft. But at 2 p.m., sailors, sunbathing on the deck, saw fighter jets coming at them in attack formation. Red flashes from the wings of the fighters were followed by explosions and blood and death. A beautiful afternoon suddenly became a nightmare. Who was attacking the USS Liberty and why? The attack on the Liberty was an attack on America. The Liberty was an intelligence ship. Its purpose was to monitor Soviet and Arab communications in order to warn both Israel and Washington should the Soviets enter the war on behalf of its Arab allies. The Liberty was armed only with 4 machine guns to repel boarders. Its request for a destroyer escort had been denied. The assault on the Liberty is well documented. With no warning, the Liberty was attacked by successive waves of unmarked jets using cannon, rockets, and napalm. The attacking jets jammed all the U.S. communications frequencies, an indication they knew the Liberty was an American ship. The air attack failed to sink the Liberty. About 30 minutes into the attack, 3 torpedo boats appearing, flying the Star of David. The Israeli boats were not on a rescue mission. They attacked the Liberty with cannon, machine guns, and torpedoes. 1 torpedo struck the Liberty midship, instantly killing 25 Americans while flooding the lower decks. The Israeli torpedo boats destroyed the life rafts the Liberty launched when the crew prepared to abandon ship, sending the message, there will be no survivors. At approximately 3:15, 2 French-built Israeli helicopters carrying armed Israeli troops appeared over the Liberty. Phil Turney could see their faces only 50 feet away. He gave them the finger. Surviving crew members are convinced the Israelis were sent in to board and kill every single surviving American left. The Israeli jets destroyed the Liberty's communication antennas, and while under attack from the jets, crew members strung lines that permitted the ship to send a call for help. The USS Saratoga and the USS America launched fighters to drive off the attacking aircraft. But the rescue mission was aborted by direct orders from Washington. When the Liberty notified the 6th Fleet it was again under attack, this time from surface ships, the fleet commander ordered the carriers America and Saratoga to launch fighters to destroy or drive off the attackers. The order was unencrypted and picked up by Israel, which immediately called off its attack. The torpedo boats and their hovering helicopters sped away. Israel quickly notified Washington it had mistakenly attacked an American ship, and the U.S. fighters were recalled a second time. The USS Liberty suffered 70% casualties, 34 killed, 174 wounded. Although the explosive state of the art ship was kept afloat by a heroic crew. Why didn't help come? No explanation has ever been given by the U.S. government for Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and President Lyndon Johnson's orders for the 6th Fleet to abort the rescue mission. Lieutenant Commander David Lewis of the Liberty told colleagues that Admiral Geis, commander of the 6th Fleet Carrier Force, told him that when he challenged McNamara's Secretary of Defense order to recall the rescue mission, LBJ, President of the United States, got on the line and said he didn't care if the ship sank. He wasn't going to embarrass an ally, Israel. The communications officer handed the transmission, was given the same accord, an account. A BBC documentary on the Israeli raid reports confusion about the attacker's identity almost resulted in a U.S. assault on Egypt. Richard Parker, U.S. political counsel to Cairo, confirms in the BBC documentary he received official communications an American retaliatory attack on Egypt was on its way. The U.S. government's official position on the USS Liberty's corresponds with Israel's. The attack was unintentional and a result of Israeli blunders. That's the official position, despite the fact that, listen carefully, audience, CIA Director Richard Helms, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, Assistant Secretary of State Louis Battle, and a long list of U.S. Navy officers, government officials, and Liberty survivors, all on record saying the Israeli attack was intentional and premeditated. According to Helms, Battle, and the minutes of a White House meeting that has been released under Freedom of Information, President Johnson believed the attack was also intentional. Helms says LBJ was furious and complained when the New York Times buried the story on page 29, but that Johnson decided he had to publicly accept Israel's explanation. Quote, this is from the actual meeting, the political pressure is simply too much. Political pressure from who? Israel and its political and economic supporters in the United States. U.S. communication personnel, intelligence analysts, and ambassadors report having read U.S. intercepts of Israeli orders to attack the Liberty. And one intercept that is now official and on file, an Israeli pilot reports that the Liberty is an American ship and asks for a repeat and clarification of his orders to attack an American ship. One Israeli, who identified himself as one of the pilots, later came to America and met with U.S. Representative Pete Makowski and Liberty survivors. The pilot said he had refused to participate in the attack when he saw it was an American ship. He was later arrested when he returned to Israel. The Liberty flew the U.S. flag, the ship's markings, GTR-5, measuring several feet in height on both sides of the bow. On the stern of the ship was clearly marked USS Liberty. Mistaking the Liberty for an Egyptian ship, as Israel claims to have done, was simply impossible. The Israeli claim the Liberty flew no flag is a lie. Two U.S. flags full of holes from the attack exist. When the first flag was shot down, crewmen replaced it immediately with a big 7-foot by 13-foot flag. This flag, with its battle scars, is on display at the National Security Agency's headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. Admiral John McCain Sr., the father of current U.S. Senator, ordered Admiral Isaac Kidd and Captain Ward Boston to hold a court of inquiry and to complete the investigation in a year? No, 5 days. In a signed affidavit, Captain Boston said President Johnson ordered a cover-up and that he and Admiral Kidd were prevented from doing a real investigation. All the Liberty survivors were ordered never to speak to anyone about the event. Their silence was finally broken when Lieutenant Commander James Innes published the work Assault on the Liberty. It is now established fact that the attack on the Liberty was intentional and was covered up by President Johnson and every administration, including this one. There has never been a congressional investigation, nor has the testimony of the majority of survivors ever been officially taken. Moreover, testimony that conflicted with the cover-up was deleted from the official record. Disgusted by the U.S. government's official stance, discounting the survivors' reports, Admiral Tom Moore, retired Chief of Naval Operations and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, organized the Moore Commission to make public the known facts about the attack and cover-up. The commission consisted of Admiral Moore, former Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy, and Admiral Merling Staring, Marine Corps General Raymond Davis, and former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia James Atkins. The commission report concluded, quote, that there is a compelling evidence that Israel's attack was a deliberate attempt to destroy an American ship and kill her entire crew. That fearing conflict with Israel, the White House deliberately prevented the U.S. Navy from coming to the defense of the USS Liberty by recalling the Sixth Fleet military rescue support while the ship was under attack. That surviving crew members were threatened with court-martial, imprisonment, or worse if they exposed the truth and the survivors were abandoned by their own government. That there has been an official cover-up without precedent in American naval history. That a danger to our national security exists whenever elected officials are willing to subordinate American interests to those of a foreign nation. In conclusion, why did Israel attack the Liberty? Was something super secret going on that is so damaging to be that it must be protected at all cost? Some experts believe Tel Aviv decided to sink the Liberty because the ship's surveillance capability would discover Israel's impending invasion and capture of Syria's Golan Heights, an action opposed by Washington. Others believe Israel was concerned the Liberty would discover Israel's massacre of hundreds of Egyptians prisoners of war, a war crime contemporaneously going on with the attack on the USS Liberty ship. Still others believe that Israel intended to blame the attack on Egypt in order to bring America into the war. It is known the U.S. was providing Israel with reconnaissance, and there were joint U.S.-Israeli covert operations against the Arabs that Washington was desperate to keep secret. Survivors with whom I've spoke said the attack was the easy part of the experience. The hard part has been living 40 years of an official cover-up and betrayal by the United States government. One survivor said he was asked to leave his church, his Baptist church, when he spoke about the Liberty incident, because the minister and fellow churchgoers felt more loyal to the official position than to this member of the congregation. Survivor Phil Tierney said, quote, being forced to live with a cover-up is like being raped and no one will believe you. Survivor Gary Brummett said he, quote, feels like someone who has been locked up for 40 years on a wrongful conviction. Until the United States government acknowledges the truth of the attack, Brummett says the survivors are forced to live with the anger and dismay of being betrayed by the United States. Survivor Bryce Lockwood has been angry for 40 years. The torpedo that killed his shipmates, wrecked his ship, and damaged his health was made in the USA. Survivor Ernie Gallo told me, quote, he has been haunted for 4 decades by the knowledge that his commander-in-chief, President Lyndon Johnson, recalled the U.S. fighters that could have prevented most of the Liberty casualties. Every American should be troubled by the fact that the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense prevented the U.S. 6th Fleet from protecting a U.S. Navy ship and its 294-man crew from foreign attack. They should also be troubled that the President ordered the Navy to determine the attack was unintentional. Paul Craig Roberts, commentary. And you think the false flag issues are a false conspiracy? I have not seen the left or the right take this issue on. I believe it's time. It would make a great story for a film or a documentary. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to our new program, Progressive Commentaries, bringing you the voices of individuals who have something important to say. And this is the forum to share it. Have a good day.